Good morning and welcome to another episode of Kings and Queens, the podcast where we read, watch, play, and discuss history's favorite scream queens and literary kings of horror. I am your host, Nat, and this week we are diving into chapter 24 of Stephen King's Holly. If you have not already, I highly recommend going back to the beginning and reading all the previous chapters with us. Last week we were spoiled. We had 2 weeks in a row of our little Miss Barbara Robinson, and we learned that she is on track to potentially being published. This week we go back to the investigation with Holly, investigating the disappearance of a Bonnie doll. As a reminder, when you hear this sound, that means I have stopped reading from the text and am instead discussing thoughts, interpretation, things like that. When the sound replays, that means the mic is back to the author. Without further ado, let's begin chapter 24 of Holly. Chapter 24, July 26th, 2021. Part 1, page 227. When Holly pulls into the handkerchief-sized Jetmart parking lot at 3:15, she sees the man she wants to interview is on duty. Excellent. She pauses long enough to hunt something on her iPad, then gets out of her car. On the left-hand side of the door, there's a bulletin board under the overhang. "Welcome to Jetmart Neighborhood," it proclaims. It's covered with notices of apartments to rent, cars and washing machines and game consoles for sale, a lost dog, we love our Rexy, and two lost cats. There's also one lost girl, Bonnie Ray Doll. Holly knows who put that one up, and hears Keisha Stone saying, "Love lost, but plenty of love left." She goes in. The store is currently empty except for her and the clerk, Emilio Herrera by name. He looks to be Pete's age, maybe a little younger. He's perfectly willing to talk. He's got a round face and a charmingly cherubic smile. Yes, Bonnie was a regular customer. He liked her and is very sorry that she has gone missing. Hopefully she will get in touch with her mama and her friends soon. She'd come in most nights around 8, Herrera says. Sometimes a little earlier, sometimes a little later. She always had a smile and a good word, even if it was just, "How are you doing?" or "What do you think about the calves?" or "How's your wife?" You know how few people take the time to do that? Probably not many, Holly says. She herself isn't apt to be chatty with people she doesn't know. Mostly contents herself with "please and thank you" and "have a nice day." Holly keeps herself to herself, Charlotte used to say, with a little grimacing smile meant to convey, "She can't help it, you know?" Not many is right, Herrera says, but not her. Always friendly, always a good word. She'd get a diet soda, sometimes one of those sweets in the rack there. She was partial to the ho-hos and the ring-dings, but mostly she'd pass them by. Young women are figure-conscious, as you probably know. "Was there anything unusual about that night, Mr. Herrera? Anything at all? Someone outside who might have been watching her, maybe standing where the video wouldn't pick him up?" "Not that I saw," Herrera says, after doing Holly the courtesy of giving it some thought. "And I believe I would have. Convenience stores like this, especially on quiet streets like Red Bank Ave, are prime targets for robbers. Although this place has never been hit, grace of God." He crosses himself. "But I keep an eye out. Who's coming, who's going, who's loitering. Didn't see anyone like that on the last night that girl you're looking for was in here. Not that I can remember, at least." She got her soda, put it in her backpack, put on her helmet, and off she went. That is such a tiny but crucial detail that King just threw in there, and I really think it is literary mastery. It also highlights Holly's job as a private investigator. In conversation, he says she put her helmet on. And I can almost guarantee you the cops would not give two shits about that, but Holly does. Why? Because she was the only one who noticed that there was no helmet with the bike. Go Holly. Holly opens her iPad and shows him what she downloaded before she came in. It's a picture of a 2020 Toyota Sienna. "Do you remember a van like this? That night or any other night? It would have had a blue stripe running down low, along the side." Herrera studies the picture carefully, then hands it back. "Seen plenty of vans like that, but it doesn't ring a bell. You know, about that night. Which you know is now almost a month ago, right?" "Yes, understood. Let me show you something else. It might refresh your memory." She plays the security video from the night of July 1st and freezes it when the van is in the background. He studies it and says, "Wow, I better clean the lens of that camera." "Kind of locking the barn door after the horse has been stolen," Holly doesn't say. "You're sure you don't remember a van like that? Maybe on another night?" "I'm sorry, ma'am, I don't. Vans are pretty common." It's what Holly expected. Another T crossed, another I dotted. "Thank you, Mr. Herrera. I wish I could have been more help." What about this boy? Do you recognize him? She shows him a picture of Peter Steinman. It's a group shot of his middle school band club, which she found online. Everything's online these days. Holly has enlarged it so that Peter, standing in the back row with a pair of cymbals, is relatively clear. Better than the JetMart security footage, anyway. He was a skateboarder. Herrera peers, then looks up when a middle-aged woman comes in. He greets her by name, and she returns the greeting. Then he gives the iPad back to Holly. He looks familiar, but that's all I can say. Those skateboard kids come in all the time. They buy candy or chips, then ride their boards down the hill to the whip. Do you know the Dairy Whip? Yes, Holly says. He's missing too, since November of 2018. Hey, you don't think we've got some kind of predator in the neighborhood, do you? John Wayne Gacy type? Probably not. This young man and Bonnie Doll are probably not even related, although she's finding this ever tougher to believe. I don't suppose you can think of any other regulars who just suddenly stop showing up, can you? The woman customer, Cora by name, is now waiting to pay for an Iron City Sixer and a loaf of Wonder Bread. Nope, Herrera says, but he's not looking at Holly anymore, who isn't a customer. Cora is. Holly can take a hint, but before moving away from the counter, she gives Emilio Herrera one of her cards. My number's on there. If you think of anything that might help me locate Bonnie, would you give me a call? Sure, Herrera says, and pockets the card. Hey, Cora, sorry to keep you waiting. What about this COVID, huh? Holly buys a can of Fanta before leaving. She doesn't really want it, but it seems only polite. At first, I was really taken aback because I thought Holly was flat lying to this man. I don't think that she is for a couple of reasons. One, she doesn't know for sure, right? She's admitted to herself that it's possible and it's looking likely, but she doesn't know for sure. Two, I think she's doing crowd control. She's trying to make sure the town doesn't start to spread rumors, which could potentially get to the perpetrators, and she doesn't want everybody to panic. I think what she's doing is right. Chapter 24, Part 2, page 229. Holly checks Twitter as soon as she's back in her apartment. There is one new response from Franklin Kraslow, Christian, proud NRA member, South is gonna rise again. It's brief. Ellen killed her baby and will burn in hell. Leave us alone. Us, Holly assumes, meaning the Kraslow clan from Bibb County. She calls Penny Doll. It's not a call she wants to make, but it's time to tell Penny what she now believes, that Bonnie may have been abducted. Possibly by someone in a van who was waiting for her at the former Bill's Automotive and Small Engine Repair. Possibly by someone she knew. Holly emphasizes the may in may have been. She expects sobs, but there are none, at least for the time being. This is, after all, exactly what Penny Doll has been afraid of. She asks Holly if there's a chance Bonnie might still be alive. There's always a chance, Holly says. Some fucker took her. The vulgarity surprises Holly, but only for a moment. Anger instead of tears. Penny makes Holly think of a bear who's lost a cub. Find him. Whoever took my daughter, you find that fucker. No matter what it costs, I'll get the money. Do you hear me? Holly suspects that tears will come later, when what Holly has told Penny has had a chance to sink in. It's one thing to have the worst fear a mother can feel locked inside. It's quite another to hear it spoken aloud. I'll do my best. It's what she always says. I was actually pretty pleased that Penny is starting to let her emotions out in a different way. Instead of being short with Holly, she is now extremely angry at this, you know, mystery target that potentially took her daughter. It is a new target for her emotions, and I think it will be beneficial for their relationship. Their professional relationship, that is. Find him, Penny repeats, and ends the call without saying goodbye. Holly goes to the window and lights a cigarette. She tries to think of what her next step should be and comes to the conclusion, reluctantly, that right now she doesn't have one. She knows of three missing people and feels their disappearances are related, but in spite of certain similarities, she has no proof of that. She's at a dead end. She needs the universe to throw her a rope. Chapter 24, Part 3, page 230. That evening, Jerome calls from New York. He's excited and happy, and why not? The lunch went well, the check duly handed over. His agent will deposit it to his account, minus her 15%. But he actually held it in his hand, he tells her, and ran his fingers over the embossed numbers. I'm rich, Holly Berry. I'm freaking rich. You're not the only one, Holly thinks. Are you also drunk? No, He sounds offended.
I had two beers.
Well, that's good. But on this one occasion, I suppose you'd have a right to get drunk. She pauses. As long as you didn't get all sloppy and vomit on Fifth Avenue, that is. The Blarney Stone is on 8th Halls, near Madison Square Garden. Holly, who's never been to New York and doesn't want to go, says, "That's interesting." Then, channeling his younger sister without knowing it, Jerome tells her it's not really the money that's blowing his mind. They're going to publish it. It started as a college paper, it turned into a book, and now it's going to be published. That's wonderful, Jerome. I'm so glad for you. She wishes her friend, who once saved her life and Bill's life in a snowstorm, could always be this happy, and knows that's not the way life works. Maybe just as well. If it did, happiness wouldn't mean anything. I thought that was a really incredible line and continues to show impeccable character growth in Holly. That's a very mature statement. It's an interesting theory, too. It kind of goes back to, you know, darkness is the absence of light. It's not its own entity. So darkness cannot exist without light, right? And I do think that people who have gone through trauma or have been through any, you know, abusive situations, such as her mother, those types of people really tend to appreciate the good things in life, even though they can acknowledge that bad things have to happen too. What's going on with the case? Have you made any progress? Holly fills him in on everything. Most of it is about Ellen Kraslow, but she doesn't neglect Tom Higgins being out of the picture. When she finishes, Jerome says, "I'd give $100 to know who the old lady was. The one who cleaned out Ellen Kraslow's trailer. Wouldn't you?" "Yes." Holly's thinking, and with a smile, that Jerome could actually afford to give $1,000, considering his recent windfall. For that matter, so could she. She is Dives Poeia, a rich girl, just like in the Hall & Oates song she used to love. To me, the most interesting thing is all the black people living in that trailer park. Not surprising, because it's at the western edge of Lowtown, but the old lady was white. I did look it up, and I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but Dives Poeia, or Puella, is truly Latin in origin, and it literally translates to being a rich girl. One thing I had wondered was, is this resident possibly related to Kraslow? And obviously it's not impossible with the different ethnicities, but it's not likely. Now, the other potential would be, could it be another resident of the trailer park? But it sounds like it's mostly an African-American population, leading me to believe further and further that this was probably Emily Harris. I also really wanted to highlight on something that I love in this book right now is there is a lot of what I would call linguistic symphony between the positive characters. And I think King does that to combat the racist over themes from the villains and the character traits of the victims. I think he's trying to show a good balance within the fight for good and evil. We have, you know, Holly and Jerome, good upstanding people that are trying to help. They're publishing advocacy literature. All these good things, and then you have the Harrises who shoot down advocacy literature and try to form people into what they want to be, and they are incredibly selfish. Really, really good contrast. What's next for you? I don't know, Holly says. What about you, Jerome? I'm going to stay in New York a while longer, until Thursday at least. My editor, I love saying that, wants to talk about some stuff, a few changes in the manuscript, plus he wants to brainstorm a book jacket concept. He says the head of publicity wants to talk about a possible tour. A tour? Do you believe that? I do, he says. I'm so glad for you. Can I tell you something about Barb? Of course. I'm pretty sure she's writing too, and I think she's getting somewhere with it. Wouldn't it be crazy if we both turned out to be writers? No crazier than the Brontes, Holly says. There were three of them, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne, all writers. I love Jane Eyre. This is true, but the one Holly especially loved as an unhappy teenager was Wuthering Heights. No idea what Barbara might be writing? I'd say poetry, just about has to be. It's about all she's been reading since she was a sophomore. Listen, Holly, I want to go for a walk. I think I could fall in love with the city. For one thing, they get it. There are actually pop-up vaccine sites. Well, don't get mugged. Keep your wallet in your front pocket, not the back, and call your mother and father. Already did. What about Barbara? Have you talked to her? I will, if she's not too busy with her secret project to take my call, that is. I love you, Holly. This isn't the first time he said it, but it always makes her feel like crying. I love you too, Jerome. Enjoy the rest of your big day. She ends the call. She lights a cigarette and goes to the window. She puts her thinking cap on. Much good it does to her. First off, I want to apologize for the sirens earlier. I live ghetto adjacent in a populated city in Michigan, so kind of an everyday thing. Sorry about that. Also, shout out to Chevy and Piper, the cats that you heard meowing in that last one. I also didn't know about the Brontes. Obviously, I know the classics like Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, but I didn't know all three of them were writers. I really wish I was more into classic lit. That's so cool. And finally, I just want to say, anytime Bill is mentioned in this book, or something sweet is remembered about him, or something reminds me of him, I put a little heart next to it. And listening to Holly and Jerome, you know, platonically explain, or even familially explain this love, I put a little heart. That is Bill Hodges incarnate, living in these people. And again, really, really stark contrast to the overing themes from our villains. Absolutely love it. Chapter 24, Part 4, page 232. Roddy Harris comes back from his usual Monday evening visit to Strikeout Lanes around 8:45. He and Emily take good care of themselves, often in ways of which dim-witted society would not approve. But his once strong hips have grown rather fragile as he advances deeper into his 80s, and it's been almost 4 years since he last rolled a ball down a hardwood lane. He still goes on most Mondays, though, because he likes to root for his team. The Golden Oldies play in the Over 65 League. Most of the men with whom he bowled when he joined the Oldies are gone, but a few are left, including Hugh Clippard, one of the sociology departments. Hugh has to be pushing 80 himself these days. He's made a pile in the stock market, and he's still got a wicked hook. Too bad it's to the Brooklyn side. Emily comes out of her little office as soon as she hears the front door close. He kisses her on the cheek and asks how her evening was. Not wonderful. We may have a slight problem, dear. You know I monitor certain people's tweets and posts. Vera Steinman, he says, and the doll woman, of course. This caused such a ridiculous amount of foreboding to me as the reader. I also just want to point out how different the language is from this different point of view in the chapter. It's downright evil. I also hate how good they are at this. The fact that they're monitoring their victims' families' social media presence. Come on now. I also check in every now and then with the Kraslows. There's not much, and they never talk about Ellen. Nobody asks about Ellen either, until yesterday. Ellen Kraslow, Roddy says, shaking his head. That bitch. That, for a moment, the word wants to escape him. Then it comes. That intransigent bitch. Thank you, Stephen King, for constantly expanding my vocabulary. Intransigent means uncompromising, inflexible. I believe this is referring to her veganism and refusal to eat liver. Raw. I might be a bitch myself, because I would not do that. She certainly was. And someone calling herself Lauren Bacall fan has been asking for information about her on Twitter. After almost 3 years? Why now? Because I'm positive that Lauren Bacall fan runs a private investigation firm. Her real name is Holly Gibney. The firm is called Finders Keepers, and Penelope Dahl has engaged her services. I am more and more convinced that Emily Harris is a witch. She is over 80 years old, has managed to glean all of this information from a single tweet. The way my jaw dropped reading that. He is paying close attention now, looming over her upturned face. He's 7 inches taller than Emily, but she's his equal in intellect, maybe in some ways his superior. She's... Again, the word dances away from him, but he catches it as he always does. Almost always. Emily is sly. How did you find out? Mrs. Dahl is very chatty on social media. Chatty Penny, he says. That girl, that Bonnie, was a mistake. Worse than the goddamn Mexican, and we can excuse ourselves for that because he was the first, I know. Come in the kitchen. There's half a bottle of red left from dinner. Wine before bed gives me acid. You know that. But he follows her. Just a splash. She gets it from the fridge and pours. A splash for him, a bit more for her. They sit facing each other. Bonnie probably was a mistake, she admits, but the heat brought back my sciatica and the headaches. I know, Roddy says. He takes her hand across the table and gives it a gentle squeeze. My poor dear with her migraines. And you. I saw you struggling for words sometimes. And your poor hands, the way they were shaking. We had to. I completely forgot to address this earlier, but I agree wholeheartedly with Emily. Roddy is struggling to bring basic language to mind when he, you know, wants to say something important or not. The words just escape him. And I will admit, Roddy has appeared to feel less positively towards Emily than I had expected based on their relationship. I thought he was going to be like over the moon in love with her. And I did think they would be equals, but Roddy has admitted some weakness, and I think there is a little bit of jealousy in there. I'm fine now. The shakes are gone, and any mental muddiness I might have been dealing with, that's gone too. He's lying. He's saving face. If he's the mastermind, why would he lie about his own aptitude? This is only half true. The shakes are gone, true enough. Well, sometimes the minutest tremble when he's very tired. But there are those words that sometimes dance just out of reach. Everyone sometimes has those blank spots, he tells himself when it happens. You've researched it yourself. It's a temporarily fouled circuit, transient aphasia. No different from a muscle cramp that hurts like Satan and then lets go. The idea that it might be incipient Alzheimer's is ridiculous. It blows my mind that he can be this academically analytic, like peer-reviewed studies, research, all of that good stuff, and still so delulu. In any case, it's done. If there's fallout, we'll deal with it. The good news is that I don't believe we'll have to. This Gibney woman has had some notable successes. Yes, I looked her up. But when those occurred, she had a partner, ex-police, and he died years ago. Since then, she mostly looks for lost dogs, chases bail jumpers, and works on a contingency basis with certain insurance companies. Small ones, none of the majors. Roddy sips his wine. Apparently, she was smart enough to find Ellen Kraslow. Emily sighs. That's true, but two disappearances almost 3 years apart don't make a pattern. Still, you know what you always say. The wise man prepares for rain while the sun shines. As of right now, this is the only, and potentially the only needed, oversight in the Harris' thought process. The two disappearances 3 years apart doesn't make a pattern. That's correct, but you have not been paying attention to where you are snatching these people from, Emily. Does he always say that? He thinks he does, or used to. Along with one monkey don't make no sideshow, a thing his father used to say. His father had that fabulous sky blue Packard. Roddy! The sharpness of her tone brings him back. You're wandering. Was I? Give me that. She takes the jelly glass with its splash of wine from in front of him and pours it down the sink. From the freezer, she takes a parfait glass containing a cloudy gray concoction. She sprays whipped cream from a can on top and puts it in front of him with a long-handled dessert spoon. Eat. Do you not want to share? He asks, but his mouth is already watering. No, you have it all. You need it. Those of you with any sort of medical or anatomic background, gray matter, what are we talking about? Brain and spinal cord. That is exclusively what we are talking about here, unless it really is an organ that's been sitting and sitting and sitting, if it's been in their fridge for a long period of time. But I highly suspect, based on context clues, she is about to feed Roddy brains to try and fix his, what did he call it? Incipient Alzheimer's. That he won't admit to. Roddy and Emily have also Pavloved themselves. This goes way, way back to classical conditioning, Pavlov's dogs. He would ring the bell, then feed them, and then it got to the point where the dogs associated the bell with food. They would start drooling every time they hear the bell. Roddy Harris has been Pavloved into drooling over human remains. Oh my God. She sits across from him as he begins to spoon the mixture of brains and vanilla ice cream greedily into his mouth. Emily watches. It will bring him back. It has to bring him back. She loves him, and she needs him. I hate how casually and daily they speak about people. And, I mean, God forbid Roddy's body deteriorates as we're murdering other people. She needs him. She loves him. I think I'm realizing that the worst thing about these people is how selfish they are. Lastly, I know I'm talking a lot, I'm sorry you guys. I just have so much to think about. This Pavlov thing, because he's been conditioned, it begs the question, are the human remnants actually helping, or is it a placebo effect? Has he been conditioned to think that this is helping him in his late 80s? Listen to me carefully, love. This woman will hunt around for Bonnie, find nothing, take her fee, and go her way. If she should present a problem, one chance in 100, if not 1,000. She is unmarried and seems to have no significant other, based on what I've read. Her mother died earlier this month. Her only other living relative, an uncle, is in an elder care center with Alzheimer's. She has a business partner, but he's apparently hors de combat with COVID. Roddy eats a little faster, wiping a dribble that runs down a seam at the side of his mouth. He believes he can already sense a greater clarity in what he's seeing and in what she's saying. You found all that on that Twitter platform? Emily smiles. There and a few other places. I have my little tricks. It's like that TV show we watch, Manifest, where the characters keep saying everything is connected. It's a silly show, but that's not silly. My point is simple, dear one. This is a woman who has no one. This is a woman who must feel quite normally depressed and grief-stricken after losing her mother. If a woman like that were to commit suicide by jumping in the lake, leaving a suicide note behind on her computer, who would question it? Her business partner might. Or he might understand completely. I'm not saying it will come to that, only that we should prepare for rain while the sun is shining. Exactly. The parfait is almost gone, and surely he's had enough. Give me that. She takes it and finishes it herself. I have further evidence that this is a placebo effect. One, Emily is probably sitting there drooling just as much as Roddy is, and that's why she took it from him before he could finish. Additionally, digestion does not happen in the span of a 5-minute conversation. There is absolutely no possible way that this man is feeling more mentally clear after shoving some brains in his mouth. Absolutely not. And finally, one thing that Emily is not considering, if she leaves another note, she's creating a second pattern that could lead to her demise. They didn't leave a note for Peter Steinman. They left one for Bonnie. Didn't leave a note for Jorge. If they leave another one, Holly will absolutely know that this is serial. Slow down, Em. Chapter 24, Part 5, page 236. Barbara Robinson is in her bedroom, reading in her jammies by the light of her bedside lamp when the phone rings. The book is Catalepsy by Jorge Castro. It isn't as good as The Forgotten City, and the title seems deliberately off-putting. A writer's declaration that he is literary, but it's pretty good. Besides, the working title of her book, Faces Change, isn't exactly favorite fireside poems for young and old. It's Jerome, calling from New York. It's 11:15 where she is, so it must already be tomorrow in the Eastern time zone. Hey bro, you're up late, and you're not partying unless it's with a bunch of mutes. No, I'm in my hotel room, too excited to sleep. Did I wake you? No, Barbara says, sitting up in bed and propping an extra pillow behind her. Just reading myself to sleep. Sylvia Plath or Anne Sexton? Teasing. A novel. The guy who wrote it actually taught up the ridge for a while. Up the ridge meaning Bell College. What's going on with you? So he tells her everything he already told his parents and Holly, spilling it out in an exuberant rush. She is delighted for him and says so. She marvels over the $100,000 and squeals when he tells her about the possible tour. Bring me along. I'll be your gopher. I might take you up on that. What's going on with you, Barbarella? She almost tells him everything, then holds back. Let this be Jerome's day. Barb, you still there? It's been pretty much the same old. Don't believe it. You're up to something. What's the big secret? Spill. Soon, she promises. Really. Tell me what's up with Holly. I kind of blew her off the other day. I feel bad about that. But not too bad. She has an essay to write. It's important. And she hasn't made much progress. Much? She hasn't even started. He recaps everything, ending with Ellen Kraslow. Barbara says yes and wow and uh-huh in all the right places, but she's just half listening. Her mind has drifted back to that damned essay again, which has to be in the mail by the end of the month. And she's sleepy. She doesn't connect the disappearances Jay is telling her about with the one Olivia Kingsbury told her about, even though Jorge Castro's novel is face down on her comforter. He hears her yawn and says, "I'll let you go, but it's good to talk to you when you're actually paying attention." "I always pay attention to you, my dear brother." "Liar," he says, laughing, and ends the call. Barbara puts Jorge Castro aside, unaware that he is part of a small and extremely unlucky club, and turns out her light. Chapter 24, Part 6, page 237. That night, Holly dreams of her old bedroom. She can tell by the wallpaper it's the one on Bond Street in Cincinnati, but it's also the museum exhibit she imagined. Those little plaques are everywhere, identifying objects that have become artifacts. Ludio Ludius next to the sound system. Bella Siderera beside the wastebasket. Cuboil Tristis Puella on the bed. Because the human mind specializes in connectivity, she wakes thinking of her father. She doesn't often. Why would she? He died a long, long time ago and was never much more than a shadow even when he was home, which was seldom. Howard Gibney was a salesman from Raygarten Farm Machinery, Inc., and spent his days traveling the Midwest selling combines and harvesters and Raygarten TrueMade tractors, all in bright red, as if to make sure nobody mistook Garton farm gear for John Deere equipment. When he was home, Charlotte made sure he never forgot who, in her words, kept the home fires burning. In flyover country, he might have been a sales dynamo, but at home, he was the original Mr. Milquetoast. Holly gets up and goes to her bureau. The records of her working life, the life she has made for herself, are either at Finders Keepers on Frederick Street or in her little home office, but she keeps certain other records, certain artifacts, in the bottom drawer of this bureau. There aren't many, and most bring back memories that are a mixture of nostalgia and regret. There's the plaque she received as a second prize in a speaking contest in which several city elementary schools participated. This was when she was young enough and still confident enough to stand up in front of large groups of people. She recited a Robert Frost poem, Mending Wall, and after complimenting her, Charlotte told her she could have won first prize if she hadn't stumbled over several words halfway through. This absolutely broke my heart. Holly's father is never addressed in the Mr. Mercedes series. I didn't even know his name until today, at least as far as I can remember. It's been a couple years. Don't come for me if I'm wrong. But that's the first time I remember hearing his name. And truthfully, hearing that Holly previously had confidence and the ability to public speak really makes me question whether or not her mother beat it out of her. And Holly's character development and growth is her coming out from her mother's thumb. Really interesting. There's a photograph of her trick-or-treating with her father when she was six, he in a suit, she wearing a ghost costume that her father made. Holly vaguely recalls that her mother, who usually took her, often dragging her from house to house, had the flu that year. In the picture, Howard Gibney is smiling. She thinks she was smiling too, although with that sheet over her head, it's impossible to tell. "I was, though," Holly murmurs, "because he didn't drag me so he could get back home and watch TV. Also, he didn't remind her to say thank you at every house, but simply assumed she would do so, as she always did." But it isn't the plaque she wants, or the Halloween photograph, or the press flowers, or her father's obituary, carefully clipped and saved. It's the postcard. Once there were more, at least a dozen, and she assumed the others were lost. After discovering her mother's lie about the inheritance, a less palatable idea has come to her. That her mother stole these souvenirs of a man Holly can remember only vaguely. A man who was under his wife's thumb when he was there, which was seldom, but who could be kind and amusing on the rare occasions when it was just him and his little girl. He took 4 years of Latin in high school and won his own award, first prize, not second, for a two-page essay he wrote in that language. The title of the essay was Quid est veritas? What is truth? Over Charlotte's strong, almost strident objections, Holly took 2 years of Latin in high school herself, all that was offered. She did not shine, as her father had done in his pre-salesman days, but she carried a solid B average and remembered enough to know that Tristis Puella was Sad Girl and Bella Siderea was Star Wars. What she thinks now, what is clear to her now, is that she took Latin as a way of reaching out to her father, and he had reached back, hadn't he? center those postcards from places like Omaha and Tulsa and Rapid City. Kneeling in front of the bottom drawer in her pajamas, she searches through these few remnants of her Tristis Puella past, thinking even that last card is also gone, not filched by her mother, who had completely erased Howard Gibney from her own life, but lost by her own stupid self, probably when she moved to this apartment. At last she finds it, stuck in the crack at the back of the drawer. The picture on the front of the card shows the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. The message, no doubt written with a Ray Garton Farm Machinery ballpoint, is in Latin. All of his postcards to her were written in Latin. It was her job, and her pleasure, to translate them. She turns this one over and reads the message. Cara Holly, delicia min amo, lude cum matre tua, max domi ero, pater tus. It was his one accomplishment, something that made him even prouder than selling a new tractor for $170,000. He had told her once that he was the only farm machinery salesman in America who was also a Latin scholar. He said that in Charlotte's hearing, and she responded with a laugh. Only you would be proud of speaking a dead language, she said. For those who don't know, I am in fact a licensed veterinary technician, and I have to tell you, Latin is not a dead language, and I was a little ruffled to hear Charlotte say that. It absolutely is not. It's used in law and medicine to this day. In fact, most of the words we use are based on Latin roots. It is not that dead of a language. Howard had smiled and said nothing. Holly takes the card back to bed and reads it again by the light of the table lamp. She can remember figuring out the message with the help of her Latin dictionary, and she murmurs the translation now. Dear Holly, I love my little girl. Have fun with your mother. I will be home soon. Your father. With no idea she's going to do it until it's done, Holly kisses the card. The postmark is too blurry to read the date, but she believes it was sent not too long before her father died of a heart attack in a motel room on the outskirts of Davenport, Iowa. She remembers her mother complaining about the cost of having the body sent home by rail. Holly puts the card on the bedside table, thinking she will restore it to the bureau drawer in the morning. Artifacts, she thinks. Museum artifacts. She's saddened by how few memories she has of her father, and dully angry at the realization that her mother's shadow has all but blotted him out. Did Charlotte steal the other cards, as she had stolen Holly's inheritance? Only missed this one, perhaps because a younger and much more timid version of Holly had been using it for a bookmark, or put it in the satchel, tartan of course, that she carried everywhere back then. She will never know. Did he spend so much time on the road because he didn't want to come home to his wife? She'll never know that either. What she does know is that he was always glad to come home to Cara Holly. What she also knows is they gave a little life to a dead language. It was their thing. Holly turns out the light, goes to sleep. Dreams of Charlotte in Holly's old bedroom. Remember who you belong to, Charlotte says. She goes out and locks the door behind her. End of chapter 24. Oof, that last line was chilling. And I think it's very true to character for Charlotte. You know, remember who you belong to, as if having children provides ownership. No, ma'am, you provide protection, safety, you know, a home. It's kind of your job as the mother. I thought this was a really interesting chapter. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, this, I think, is the first multiple POV chapter that we've had. We saw Barbara and Jerome, we saw Holly, we saw Holly's dreams, and we saw Rodney and Emily Harris. I really felt like that energized the chapter all the way through as things are starting to come to a head for them. I'm very excited for where this is going to go. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you come back next week. Again, any new listeners, I have a couple from around the world now. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here. Please feel free to join us every Sunday. I drop every single week. If not, no worries. Just remember, it's all a bunch of hocus pocus. Don't forget to like and subscribe.